Also, my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, Aaron, I just got back from Las Vegas. I'm going to go right back up with this as another bonus episode over this weekend. You know, we're on our pledge dive right now. Now, folks, we're not going to bore you with a whole lot of details. We just want to remind you that we do have our pledge drive going on my donate page. You can either donate a little bit on the monthly basis, or you can donate
a little bit once.
A little bit once.
Or a little bit more once.
My brain stopped working.
Or even a little bit more than that once.
Even a little bit more than that. We've got lots of rewards. We've got my new book. And that's what I went out to Las Vegas and I did a PowerPoint program. Always before with my other stuff I've done, you know, I've got the Underground Railroad movie and I went out to Las Vegas with the library out there on Black History Month a couple years ago and showed the Underground Railroad movie. And then I showed Gangland Wire 2 years ago, and it was mainly I've shown the movie. I've not really done that much talking, just take questions afterwards and maybe tell some stories. Well, this time I had
a book.
I couldn't just show the movie. I did show a couple of little clips from it, but mainly I showed some wiretaps, because that's part of the charm of the book, is you're going to be able to read and listen. If you get the electronic version, you're going to be able to listen to the actual wiretaps and audio from the hidden microphones that got Nick Savellan, Tuffy DeLuna, and Joe Augusto and Joey Lombardo, Joey the Clown out of Chicago, and people like that talking about skimming money from Las Vegas and talking about Lefty Rosenthal and what a scumbag he is and how they got to get Lefty under control and plotting about having meetings and coming up with codes for the airlines when they're going to meet somebody at the airplane. You know, if Joe Augusto calls Tuffy and he says, you know, Tom is going to be at 6:35, take him. Actually, if it's going to be Tom, take him $6.35. That was a code. Well, that means that it was a TWA plane from Las Vegas that lands at KCI Airport at 6:35 that evening. I have a whole segment on them trying to come up with codes for the different airlines that never fails to get a laugh. Never fails to get a laugh.
And they refer to the money coming back as sandwiches?
As sandwiches, yeah. You know, what's interesting is the only wiretaps I have were the wiretaps that the audio that was put in as evidence, and they didn't find the need to snip out one of the audios that said they were bringing back sandwiches, but that's what they were referring to them as, Bill Owsley and them. Bill Owsley and his fellow agents knew that, and they just knew they were coming in with money, but they never really talked about it. I don't have an actual soundbite that refers to the word sandwiches.
Would have been embarrassing when they, took them down.
Yeah.
If the guy had reached in his...
And had a sandwich.
Had an actual sandwich in his...
Pastrami on rye.
Yeah, in his left pocket, and then he reaches in the right pocket inside and pulls out another sandwich.
Gets a turkey sandwich
like
out
corned
of the right
beef
pocket.
Or something. Like, dang, this is some good sandwiches they're flying back.
So it was a nice program. They got a really nice theater and a nice audiovisual setup. There's about 30 to 50, I don't know, probably, say 40 people were there.
140, just say that. Who knows? If they weren't actually there, they don't know. They should have been there, though. I wish I could have been there. just there was no way for me really to come out there, you know, because it cost money. Even if I had flown out that day and back, it would have been $150, $200 I don't have at the moment. But
it would have been more than that. Just because
I've seen
overnight.
Gary do presentations before, like here in Kansas City at the Plaza Library for the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library System, and phenomenal presentations.
Well, thank you. Thank you. They seemed to like it. They all applauded and they laughed at the appropriate. That's how I know if the audience laughs at the appropriate places, even if they applaud, that's not real giveaway for sure. But then if they ask good, solid questions that show they were paying attention, I didn't remember how to explain if you're skimming money from a Las Vegas casino using the fill slip method. And so there's a dealer, or actually a former pit boss in the crowd, and so he held up his hand and was asking questions after. And he asked one question. He said, I can tell you how that fill slip scam works. So he proceeded to tell me and the crowd exactly how the fill slip scam worked. It's really kind of complicated. It's hard for me to explain. I guess you work as a pit boss or in a casino in a dice at the dice table or the blackjack table. And basically what it is, a fill slip, you fill out a slip that says there's so much money that's been taken off the table. Only what you do is you fill it out for less money and you stick it down and then you take the money, the amount that's on the fill slip, say you put $500 on the fill slip, but you actually have $800. So you take $500 off the table and send it to the count room, and the fill slip is matched up with that for $500, but there's an extra $300 that didn't get. So I believe
that didn't make it.
Didn't make it. I think that's what he was saying. He didn't explain it that simply. I'll tell you that right now. It was more complicated the way he explained it.
Well, you would think there's cameras and, you know, there's other people there.
Yeah, I know. So, I know. You got to have quite a few people. He said you have to have the whole crew in on the deal. Everybody that has anything to do with the deal has to be in on it.
Well, no wonder they were so worried about. They had that moratorium because they didn't. They were concerned that other people were skimming their skim.
Oh yeah, that was a big one. That was a big one. As Carl Thomas said, we just take it out of the count room. He said you peek off the security guy in front. Now he knows something's going on, but he didn't know what's going on. And then everybody inside the count room is connected. Now he said the problem. He said you just take several hundred. You just count down. Boom, boom, boom. Take down $40,000. But the problem with that is if the guy says he's taking $2,000 a day out, he may be taking $2,400 a day out. And Nick Savella says, well, how do you know? And Thomas says, I just know because these are my guys and I trust them. They've been with me for a long time. So that's,
But you don't really know.
You
can just trust the guy.
You can't really trust anybody.
You get your most trusted guy in there because when it comes to just handling cash.
Really, really.
It's pretty easy to put an extra $100, on the door.
It is. Man, we've got some fans out there that have been pit bosses or stick men or dealers or something. Why don't you tweet us or go on my Gangland Wire Facebook page or comment on the show notes on this show and tell us what your experiences have been in maybe somebody trying to steal money for a casino. Because I know, like Carl Thomas said in one of the wires, he told Carl Savella and Nick, and he said, Carl, he said, I imagine you and the old man here, and he was talking about his older brother Nick, he said, you and the old man here have sat around for hours trying to think of ways to scheme and get money. He said, me and Frank and Shepard and my guys, he said, we sat around the kitchen table for as much as 6 hours a time trying to figure out how to take money out of these joints, because I love to take money out of these joints here out here in Las Vegas. So probably some of you former or maybe present, current day, we won't give your name up if you're a current day employee, or we won't give your name up if you're a former employee, but, get a hold of us and make some comments on this and tell us what your experiences have been with people scamming money out of Las Vegas casinos. Of course, the customers are always trying to scam, too. I remember this one guy I used to I had a little job kind of a – it was a lawyer job as a contractor with the Gaming Commission here in Missouri. And I was listening to a hearing of a dealer who went to another casino and got on the blackjack table. And what he was doing He was keeping some chips underneath his hands real close to the line, and if he looked like he got a good hand, then he would slip a couple of more up so he would increase the bet. But see, you're not supposed to increase the bet once the card started going down.
Yeah.
And it was pretty fine line. We had the video, but what mainly we had an old gal who was a longtime dealer and been doing this a long time, and she was adamant. She said there was a term for that, and I've forgotten it already. Again, if you're a dealer out there, you'll know what this term is. He said he was doing that. He was trying to increase the bet, and he did it once, and that's why. And I thought that's what he did, and I watched him, and I caught him doing it again, and that's when she called the security and the pit boss over, and they busted him, got his name. And you know, this guy was a dealer at one of the other casinos. Well, you know, when you gamble at a casino now, they know exactly how much you're gambling, because you just don't go in there with cash money and anonymously anymore. You get a card, and they keep track of your gambling, how much you spend. And this guy was losing as much as $25,000 a year, and he had about a $40,000 a year job, so he was losing over half his salary every year at other casinos besides the one he worked at.
Well, no wonder he was stacking the chips up when he had a good hand.
Yeah,
he needed to make up for those losses.
He needed to make up.
Should have been a tax attorney. Maybe you could have got him a deduction.
Really? Well, anyhow,
gambling loss is not an actual taxable deduction.
No, it's not. It's not. You can't deduct any more than what you claim as winnings. I remember that. So go to our donate page and get us some money, please. We need some money. We won't ask for any more. That's kind of the...
We're not asking for anything more than money, actually.
Than money, right, right. We're not going to go out and break your legs or anything. We're not going to send Aaron around with these boys to rough you up a little bit, intimidate you. We wouldn't do anything like that, folks.
I'm not very intimidating, actually, well, despite what the Milwaukee Mob Twitter account wants to say.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Milwaukee Mob tweeter said they were going to send Aaron out to get money, didn't they?
I don't know if he said that. He just said we were the best crime fighters in the business.
I think he did say something about that. I can't remember. Anyhow.
You know, what we need to do as an episode is we could record it. I don't know if they would answer, but call that FBI tip line. You haven't done it yet. I haven't done it yet. We've got a couple of tips sitting on the site.
I haven't been that good at tips.
Well, but nonetheless, it'd be an interesting conversation.
It would. To see how they responded.
Yeah, tell them we're recording them. Yeah. We're calling because we have some hot tips.
It's probably this is your FBI tip line. At the sound of the tone, please leave your tip.
That would work too.
But I'm gonna tell one. It's gonna be another bonus episode. We'll between the Berdella episodes, in order to try to encourage you to support us over the next year. You know, our third season's coming up in April. That will be the start of our third season. Can't believe we've been doing this for 3 years. Can you, Aaron? This will be our third year. 2 years, two solid years, and be our third year next April.
I was looking at the iTunes account here this afternoon, and there was like 22. People that had rated the show.
We do. We have 22 reviews.
Only, I don't know if, is that the total number of reviews? I saw
reviews.
Three at the bottom and a lot of 5 stars.
Oh, they're all 5 stars. Let me read some of them. They're kind of, I like them. Of course, it always makes me feel good. Some of the most recent ones. Start out with the most recent one here. KC is very lucky to have Gary. I really like that one. That's from Josh. KC is very lucky to have Gary, and I'm glad to see they're continuing with the podcast. Then we've got Jethro 5 Cents. This was in December. Great true crime story. If you like the movie Casino, you have to listen to this. Here's another one. The most recent one, January 4th, 2017. Anthony 2257 says, great podcast. Keeps getting better. Here's a guy, Bud Casanova, December the 20th. He was listening to our Janitor in Drum Part 2. Fascinating story and very well delivered. I listened to it again. Thank you for sharing your stories, Buddy Casanova.
Now, was that the one with Jim Paydar?
Jim Paydar, yes, the retired
Chicago police detective, who actually worked the case.
Yeah, that was a heck of a story, too.
Our interview with him is two parts. Then.
It is, yeah. That was part two. That was in part two. Yeah, that was a heck of a story. I'd recommend, if you haven't listened to those, that two part. Actually, there's three in a row. I kind of talk about it in general terms. Then we get the next episode. We call that one Mobsters in a Drum, and then we get Jim Paydar to come on and talk about it, and he actually worked the case, and he said they nicknamed it Janitor in a Drum. A lot of detectives, if they have an unusual case or kind of a big-time case, will come up with a little nickname like that for it. Like we had one, we called it the River Hills Caper, and I can't think of any others. That one comes right off the top of my head. Here's another one, December 8th, 2016, M. Kerr 4. Very entertaining and interesting stories. Here's a guy named Bolyard. Maybe it's a gal. I don't know. We did have Kim that called in, the Atlanta copper, who gave us a little, who told me she loved the podcast. And she actually, I called her back. She left a phone number because she just called and left me a message. And she just wanted to congratulate us and encourage us to keep putting these stories out. And I called her back and talked to her and recorded her. And she did a little promo, a little lead-in promo for one of our shows.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you record that voicemail message?
Yeah, I did. I got it. I kind of cut it down just a little bit and then put it in at the start of, I think, the last show, the bonus episode. I put Kim in as leading in. Actually, I got a message from her. Right after that, that laughingly said, oh, she put LOL at the end. I guess that's what it means, laugh out loud. She said something about, because I said a copper out of Atlanta, so she liked it. I called her a copper out of Atlanta. She's probably listening to this one too, aren't you, Kim?
I hope so.
Bolyard, great podcast. Lots of information and good guests. Wish they would sort out the audio problem. Sometimes it's hard to hear the conversations. Other than that, absolutely love the show. Well, I think...
Is he talking about our conversation?
Yeah.
Or is he talking about the conversations like Ken Edo recordings?
It might be some of those recordings. I'm not sure. But Mr. Bolyard, we are constantly trying to get this audio right. And we got some money this last year from one of our sponsors, one of our fans. And it gave us enough money, and we did buy a new microphone. I've got a new microphone. We got a new... audio recorder. We're kind of messing around with some of the gain and everything here lately, so I think it's gotten better. I know we had a little period of time there where we had what we call clipping in it, but I feel confident if it's not getting better, if you have any problems, please get a hold of us.
Now, when we're recording this, it's usually two or three different kind of platforms. Gary has a Zoom recorder, kind of a handheld,
right,
that we run one of the outputs to. We have this Genesis rack mount recorder that our fan Barry was kind enough to help us out with the purchase of. And of course, Gary forgot to say he got a couple pair of headphones, one for himself at home for right, when he's editing, and then he bought a couple pair out of that money that we got from Barry for the studio here.
Right.
Along with a microphone that we take off the table when Gary's not here.
When I was editing at home, I was just editing with, you know...
Like earbuds?
Not earbuds, with just a decent set of speakers hooked to my computer.
Yeah, it's much easier with headphones.
I need to use headphones, and so I think that helps too, because I'll amp up the sound a little bit and clip it, edit it a little bit better, because I can hear it better. It's all a learning process, folks. I mean, I was not, I did not grow up in the radio business. I was a policeman for 25 years, and I was a lawyer for about the last 15 years.
Well, so, you're still a lawyer.
And I'm still a lawyer, but I'm not a professional radio guy. And Aaron's a comedian and a, what else do you do, Aaron?
Yeah, well, besides the Big Dumb Fun Show?
Yeah.
I'm almost a professional radio guy.
You're almost a professional. He's got a radio voice.
I've been a professional radio guy in the past, I guess.
But you're not the tech guy either. You're the personality.
Well,
you can do tech stuff.
Yeah, I'm kind of, in the instance here,
with
Gangland Wire, I'm on the other side of the wall. I'm running the board. I've got the sound through the laptop or the intros or the sound bites that we play. And sometimes Gary gives me notes that I can read along with to try to keep up with what he's talking about. And I do a little research now and then myself. A lot of people maybe don't know that. I am always pitching Gary, I think, on some ideas or somebody I maybe had a conversation with who knows a cop, or there is a cop, or they're a retired cop. And I'll be like, well, this might be kind of interesting. What about this? And I just send it to Gary, and I don't hear back. And eventually, he picks up a thing or two, like Most Wanted Wednesdays.
Yeah.
That was kind of out of a pitch session.
Yeah.
Where I said, well, let's have a little something, just a small something every day, and we'll name it something like, you know, Mugshot Monday or whatever. Most Wanted Wednesday is I was coming up with something that, you know, kind of catchy, if you will. And he's like, well, this one seems good. And we've got some traction with it. You know, I'm John Q. Public in the, you know, I might be the sidekick, you know, when we're climbing up the side of a building, he knows where we're going and I'm just following along, hoping we get there.
There's another guy. Wow. What an amazing podcast. This is, I've had a conversation or two with this guy, Austin Bonnerf. I'm always getting on my phone to check it out and listen to the next podcast episode. Gary is an awesome story. Oh, I like this guy. Gary is an awesome storyteller, and that is probably because he lived it. He was part of the history when talking about organized crime in KC. If you get into mob history and the history of the KC crime family, this is the podcast for you. Check it out. And we go outside of the KC history. We do a lot of Chicago stuff, and we've done an L.A. mob story. We've done Murder Incorporated out of New York City. I'm starting to make some connections. I'm going to start talking about Carlos Marcello and the New Orleans family also. So we're kind of moving a little bit into some serial killer stuff, too. And we've started with Kansas City, and we'll probably get outside of Kansas City, but we've got our friend Troy Cole that's, if you're listening to the Burdella story, why, he's telling that right now, and he's from Kansas City and worked that case. And then we had Joe Langer and Tommy Robinson that did the
Richard Grissom.
Richard Grissom Jr. case, and they're from Kansas City, and I know them. We were able to get them on real easy.
Have you heard of the vampire killer? It was a Kansas City, Kansas guy who killed, I want to say, four people, ate the part of the leg of one of them.
No,
they dubbed him like the vampire killer or something.
How long ago was that?
This was some time ago. I just happened to run across it. Mm-hmm. There was, and then another person that we've talked with who was a former store owner here in town who had Bob Burdella coming in and out buying liquor with some of his fruit hustlers over the day, and asked about, there was a guy who was the, like a Gillum Park murderer.
Right, Rayshon Jackson. I remember that case. He was killing street prostitutes all around Midtown for quite a while, and I can't remember. You know, I know the detective. I reached out to him, and he never got back to me. I don't know. I just haven't made another run on him.
Yeah, that would be, I think, you know, I'm always kind of fishing out there. Sometimes I think even current event news type stuff is good for us, because we have talked about some of the, like, the school shootings and the terrorist attack in Paris back in the day.
We did a mob update.
A mob update.
Just recently. Yeah.
That was the most current stuff we've ever done.
Yeah, that was.
Which I did a little background research. You know, when we interviewed Martin J. McNally, he mentioned the fact that he had been in the Navy and that he had flown on a crew member on a P-3 anti-submarine plane.
Right.
Out of Washington. And so doing a little, you know, what'd you call it? Investigative journalism, I guess. I reached out to the Naval Air Station at Whidbey Island and spoke with a person from their public affairs office, told her, well, here's who I am, why I'm calling, and trying to maybe, you know, kind of pin some material or pin, you know, find out if there's any information about the P-3s and about them flying out of Whidbey Island Naval Air Station. And I got a call back, which I saved that recording, and this is in a bonus episode, so me building the case that Martin J. McNally may, in fact, be D.B. Cooper.
Because he was stationed out there at that time.
By his own admission, he was stationed and flew as a crew member on a P-3 anti-submarine plane. And years ago, I performed there as a comedian.
Oh, really?
One night at, like, the, I don't know, the Officers Club or whatever. But it was many, many years ago. And I got a call back from somebody from their public affairs office. And they left me a voicemail message. I recorded it. And here it is.
Just as, in between other things, I was looking through newspapers for McNally. You mentioned that he worked on a P-3 for sure. The P-3s were only here for a short amount of time in the 60s. I think we've hit a dead end as far as our information. If you knew specifics about what squadron he was in and specific time frames, maybe I could help. But if it was a P-3, there was such a small window from, like, June 69 to January 70th that the PDs were even located here. Thanks, and if you have any other questions, 360-257-2286.
To go to the previous message, press 4. To transfer.
Mr. Ben Ellickson, a great show. As a tradesman and lifelong Chicagoland resident, I accidentally rubbed up against many outfit guys. They are not flashy, they're low profile, and walked among us. This podcast is unique in that it is presented from the view of a law enforcement officer who approaches stories of these people in a very honest way. His hometown accent and style is refreshing, as is his honest assessment of the people who serve as his subject matter. This is well-flowing, interesting, and entertaining. This is a podcast that is unique in that it is presented from the view of law enforcement, yet who approaches stories of these people in a very... somehow that got in there twice. His hometown... that's all the same. This is a well-flowing, interesting, and entertaining podcast. I've listened to a couple of shows now, and Gary does a great job. The Tropicana Skimming episode is a particular favorite of mine. I found this podcast a few weeks ago, and I feel like I've found something new and interesting in true crime. Must say I fell in love with the show and the information that the host and their guests share with us, the fans. Best of all, to me, is the understanding of how the police work with the DA on removing riffraff off the streets. Anyone interested in true crime should be exposed to this site. Gary and Aaron provide true insight to the mind of the criminal, as Gary is a retired detective with KCPD. The facts are presented in such a way that the listener can reach their own conclusions. These podcasts are unique. Bravo, excellent source of information for anyone interested in organized crime. Podcasts are produced well and are entertaining. Highly recommended. So that's what a lot of our fans think of us, Aaron. What do you think?
I think that people should tell us what they think of us.
Keep telling us what you think of us.
Give us a review on iTunes. Give us some stars, 5 preferably.
Yeah.
And remember to put a hit out on our donate button. Although we're all doing research here and gathering more material for additional episodes, there are Freedom Information Act requests that are pending.
And there are.
And there are hundreds of dollars to get that information out. And we want to share it with you.
If I had the money, I could get a lot more details. But, you know, that's too much.
I mean, it was great. In the bonus episode last time, you brought in that affidavit from Ken Edo that we read from, or you read from. And
That was interesting.
Signed by Ken Edo, was a great piece of original source material.
Yeah, I talked to our friend Red Mamet from up in Chicago. He's a former mob guy who went to the witness protection program and testified against a bunch of those Chicago guys. And I talked to him about this whole Ken Edo and the affidavit. And you know, we talked about that famous picture, the Last Supper picture of those mob guys. Everybody, if you've ever paid much attention to mob, you've seen this. It's picture of all these mob guys, and they're Chicago mob guys sitting around a table in a restaurant. And Red Ramette knows the guy that snagged that thing. He doesn't know exactly the circumstances, but he got a copy of it a long time ago, and somehow it's just worked into kind of the popular culture, shall we say, and the FBI's used it in cases to show different mob guys and that they were together, and have somebody like Ken Edo or Red Ramette then point them out and identify them and say who did what and who was who in the hierarchy. So we're going to do a show on the guy whose house, we found out whose house it came from, a guy named DeVarco, and he's one of the members in that, and he got it from the IRS agent that snagged it. He just doesn't know if they had a legitimate search warrant or not. The Chicago Tribune article says they snagged it without a search warrant, so we still don't know.
But it was an IRS agent, not an FBI.
Yeah, it was IRS, and that's what Red said also, and that's what the Tribune said. But, you know, we've asked for money, and we bragged on ourselves. Now, let me tell you a mob story. This is out of Las Vegas. You know, I just got back from Las Vegas, and I ran into a guy who worked in the DA's office back in the 70s when these mob investigations of the skim was occurring. And the metro police, which became a combined sheriff's department and city of Las Vegas police department, combined during this time. They had a longtime sheriff named Ralph Lamb. Ralph Lamb was kind of an old-time sheriff, you might as well have been riding a horse and carrying a six shooter and running people out of town. When mobsters would come out to Las Vegas, the story was that Ralph Lamb would have them brought into him at the station and threatened to beat the crap out of them and throw them in jail on trumped up charges so they didn't turn around and leave town. Now, part of that was Ralph Lamb blowing his own horn. Ralph Lamb, actually, I was doing a research on Lefty Rosenthal. Lefty Rosenthal was a Robert De Niro character in the movie Casino, and he was actually a Chicago mob guy in the Stardust that set up the skim and was effectively running the Stardust. The guy that owned it, Alan Glick, had got a Teamsters loan, and in order to get that Teamsters loan, he had to allow Lefty Rosenthal to come in and run the casino and set up the skim and not say anything about it. Ralph Lamb, Lefty Rosenthal, applied during this time in the early 70s, and everybody knew Lefty Rosenthal was a longtime mob associate out of Chicago. Lefty Rosenthal had a lot of connections in Florida because he had just come, when he came to Las Vegas, he had been running a book and running gambling operations for the Chicago outfit down in Florida. And he had gone back down and applied for a horse racing license. He had purchased a horse race, he had purchased a racehorse, and he wanted to run the racehorse down there in the Florida races. And he had applied for the license, and you have to go through a little bit of a background check. And this rough and tough anti-criminal, anti-mob Sheriff Ralph Lamb submitted a letter testifying that Lefty Rosenthal was a fine, upstanding guy. So I'm not so sure about Ralph Lamb. Well, Ralph Lamb runs against a former Las Vegas police sergeant named John Moran. Moran, obviously, if he was only a sergeant, was a pretty ambitious fellow to go from sergeant to then running against Ralph Lamb for sheriff, and he won. And he took, and at that same point in time, they combined the Metro Police and the Sheriff's Office into one big unit. When Moran took it over, he took over the old intelligence unit, which that's what I worked on with. It was the Kansas City Police Department, was the intelligence unit, and those are the local policemen who will work, organize crime and work with the FBI, and they have to be trusted. And all good intelligence units belong to a national organization called the Organization of Law Enforcement Intelligence Units. The organization formed in California, and you have to prove from your fellow police officers that you are clean. For example, and what they do if Overland Park, it's a local police department here in a large suburb of Kansas City, if they apply to be a member of law enforcement intelligence unit organizations, the organization will come to the Kansas City Police Department, and they'll come to the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and they'll come to the Kansas Highway Patrol or the KBI in Kansas. They have a Kansas Bureau of Investigation. All of which, all three of those organizations are members of the LEIU, and they will ask them about Overland Park. Are they okay? Are they clean? So what happened, the word got around that under Ralph Lamb, the intelligence unit was not clean. As a matter of fact, they had one officer, a guy named Joe Blasco, that ended up getting popped in a burglary with Tony Spilotro. And he had been feeding them information. The Bureau had picked this up for the last two or three years before that this Joe Blasco was a member of the intelligence unit and had been feeding information to Tony Spilotro in particular and Frank Rosenthal and other mob guys on everything that he could learn that the FBI was doing and that his unit was doing. He finally got kicked out of the unit, and he ended up getting indicted for being involved with this burglary. But they were kicked out of LEIU. When Moran took it over, he put in a guy named Kent Clifford. Kent Clifford, I interviewed him for my movie Gangland Wire. I went out there to Las Vegas and interviewed him and some former FBI agents and some former casino employees. And Kent Clifford had taken over the intelligence unit, and he started telling me a story about when he first took it over. And he immediately started kicking people out, of course. He said he walked in, it was in December, right before Christmas, and he walked into the office one day, and there was about 10 cases of whiskey. He said one corner was almost piled to the ceiling with cases of whiskey.
What was the problem?
The problem was,
no one was drinking the whiskey.
Nobody was drinking the whiskey. Kent Clifford knew there had been problems in the unit. Casinos are always looking to corrupt law enforcement. They're looking to corrupt anybody because that way they get away with what they want to get away with back in those days. He turns to his guys. Guys are all sitting around at their different desks. That's usually how an intelligence unit will be. Have a separate office for the sergeant and separate for the commander, for the captain. And then there'll be a big squad room with, you know, 8 or 10 guys sitting at their desks. So he turns to the guys and he said, "Hey," he said, "what's this?" Then one of them came up to him and said, "Well, commander," he said, that's our Christmas." "What do you mean, your Christmas?" "That's our Christmas from the Strip." He said, "You mean the clubs, the casinos on the Strip donate that to you, just to this unit every year at Christmas?" Oh, yeah, they take good care of us. He looked at the guy and he raised his voice so everybody would hear. He said, "You guys get this stuff out of here and I never want to see this again. And you're never to take anything from any casino ever." And they didn't like it because they were used to getting a lot of perks from the casino. So, he started cleaning up the unit, kicked some guys out, brought some new people in. And he really got aggressive.
Did they get recertified?
They did get recertified. Shortly after that, they got recertified. Good question, Aaron. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, because I remember when I was an intelligence unit here, I remember reading some document that came through from LAI saying they had been kicked out. And I don't remember the document that came through saying they were readmitted, but I do remember by the later 70s, we were working with them again and calling them, and they were calling us, and we were exchanging information because we were always exchanging information because we had so many of our Kansas City mob guys that are going back and forth to Las Vegas. And plus, they would, if somebody from Kansas City or from anywhere in the area close by, almost the whole state of Missouri, applied for a dealer's license or a gaming license. We had a local company, Applebee's Restaurant, had applied to get a gaming license. They just wanted to put some slot machines in a restaurant they were opening, and so they inquired of us about the ownership of Applebee's. And so, you know, we started working with them again. Kent Clifford, he got aggressive. And this guy, I interviewed him quite a little bit. He is an aggressive dude. And they started following Tony Spilotro. They started following all of Tony Spilotro's guys. He had about 6 guys. Frank Culotta was one of them. A guy named Herbie Blitzstein was one of them. They called him Lurch. I can't think of his name now. But those were 3 of the names I remember. They were all career professional criminals that came out to join Tony Spilotro's, what he called the hole-in-the-wall gang, out in Las Vegas. Now, perhaps you wonder why they call it the hole-in-the-wall gang. You think it was because they were like Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid?
I thought it was because they knock holes in the wall and then they rob the place.
You've been reading, Aaron. You have been reading, or you've been listening. Do we have that on the podcast before?
I don't know if we had that on the podcast, but that was really more of a good guess.
Yeah, that's the deal.
I was going to say, what about Frank Sweets?
Frank Sweets, he's in Chicago. He didn't come out.
He came out one time. He got upset and went back there.
Right.
And like, killed a bar owner because we interviewed the guy's son who wrote a book.
Now you got it mixed up. That's Lurch. That's one of Tony Spilotro's guys.
Oh, that was
they
Lurch.
Called him Lurch, and he went back to Chicago and killed Paul Scharf's father just because he was mad, just because Scharf had kicked. That's the kind of people that worked for Tony Spilotro during this time. The kind of guy, just because this bar owner who had no connection to any kind of mob stuff, no money things going on with any mob guys, just John Doe bar owner, and he had kicked Lurch's ex-wife out of, and it wasn't even his current wife, his ex-wife, out of his bar one night, and he didn't think that was right, so he traveled back to Chicago, drove up there, walked in the bar late at night, and killed the bar owner and his barmaid. And walked out, and nobody ever knew who it was for a long time. You have to go back and listen to the episode Murder in McHenry County, where we interviewed the son of the guy who was killed and how he found out that Lurch is the one that killed his father. It's a heck of a story. I'd recommend you go back and listen to that one.
Yeah, and he's got a book, too, with it.
Right, Murder in McHenry. So get this book, go back and listen to our podcast, look him up, Paul Scharff, PaulScharff. It's a pretty interesting story.
But the hole in the wall gang, you don't have any sound bites on that jump drive on the wall here, do you?
No, no, no.
Sometimes, you know, Gary will come in and he's got a USB drive and there's sound bites on it that we'll play back that you
I don't.
Sweeten the episode, if you will. Kind of like this one.
Have anything to say, sir?
I got nothing to say. I got nothing to do with this.
Are you guilty?
Of course not.
You know that one where Rodney Dangerfield came out of the courthouse and
the press attacked him, asked him if he was guilty. That's a good idea. Ask a mob guy that's coming out, just been indicted and had to post bond, are you guilty? Yeah. Well, yeah, I am. Let me go back in and turn myself in.
Yeah, let me say something incriminating here.
Let me go off to the penitentiary. Yeah, dumbest mobster ever. Anyhow, going back to the story of Kent Clifford. So his guys, Kent Clifford's guys, two of his guys start following one of Spilotro's gang, see him leave the Upper Crust restaurant, which was a restaurant that I think Frank Collada owned. It was a pizza place in Las Vegas, and they always hung out there. If you guys have ever seen that picture of Tony Spilotro and Frank Collada and a couple other mobsters sitting around a little table right in front of a restaurant, kind of looked like the Soprano crew sitting in front of a restaurant on a sunny day, that's Frank Collada's restaurant, the Upper Crust, and that's the crew. So one of their guys left. A couple of Kent Clifford's detectives that worked for him happened to see him leave and said, well, let's just follow him. So they started following him, and the guy, they were following him pretty close, and the guy pulled over and got out, and he realized he was being followed, and he got out, and he pulled a gun out and he started walking back towards the car. So the coppers just jump out and blow him away. And they found a gun and they traced the gun down. Everybody tried to say, oh, they just executed him and they planted the gun on him. But Kent Clifford said they traced that gun and it found it had been purchased at one point in time by this guy's brother in Chicago. So I don't think a policeman can get a gun purchased by a Chicago outfit guy's brother and use it as a throwdown. Maybe they came. Maybe they're that slick and sophisticated, but I doubt it. So, you know, they were not indicted, and there was no repercussions legally for the officers. But Tony Spilotro was mad. He was madder than hell, and he decided he wanted to have these coppers hit, and somebody drove by one of their houses one night, and I think Spilotro probably really wasn't going to hit them, but he put out the word he was, and somebody fired a shotgun at the front of one of their houses shortly thereafter. And then he put the word out that there was a hitman coming into town on an airplane, particular airplane from Denver. And Clifford somehow got to Clifford, and they ran out the airport, but they couldn't figure out who it was. But he was convinced by this point in time that Tony Spilotro, who he knew was a Chicago outfit underling, was going to hit one of his police officers, or two of them, actually, that killed one of Spilotro's men. Kent Clifford's kind of an old school guy. You know, you think Ralph Lamb was an old school sheriff kind of guy. Well, Kent Clifford was, he was a square John, no corruption, no even hint of corruption about him, sheriff, Western sheriff kind of guy. Kent Clifford gets on a plane. He asks nobody's permission. He does this all on his own. He gets on a plane. He flies to Chicago. And he's found out from the FBI where IUPA and Jackie Cerrone and a couple other guys live up on the north side of Chicago in the suburbs. He goes to a couple of their houses and he knocks on the door and he asks for them and they aren't there. Just by happenstance, they weren't there. I don't know what happened if one of them had been there. He then goes to Alan Dorfman's office, I believe. He's directed to go to a lawyer's office. He goes to the lawyer's office and he tells the lawyer, he said, now, I know you know these guys. And the lawyer, of course, doesn't acknowledge anything one way or the other. He said, but here's what I want you to send a message. He said, I'm in town for 24 more hours. I want you to tell them that they need to let me know and promise me that any hit on my officers is called off at this level. And if not, he said, I'll go back to Las Vegas, but anything ever happens to any of those men, I'm going to come back here in those houses I went to. I will kill everybody that moves inside that house. Thank you very much. And he goes back to his hotel room, and the lawyer calls him and said, Mr. Clifford, he said, just wait there in the hotel room. There's going to be a meeting tonight. He said, I'm going to carry your message to some people. Clifford says, I want to go to that meeting. He said, no, you can't go to that meeting. Clifford says, no, I'm going to the meeting. He said, no, you can't go to the meeting. I'm not telling you where it is. You're not going. He said, okay. He said, hey, here's what you do. He said, you just wait in that hotel room. If you get a call and says, have a nice trip back to Las Vegas, you'll know that they agree and any hit on your officers is called off. Later on that evening, about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, he gets a phone call. The voice on the other end, it wasn't even the lawyer, it was just an unknown voice, says, Commander Clifford, have a nice trip back to Las Vegas. He drove back to Las Vegas and there was never a problem again. Now that's, and that was in the reported in the newspapers at the time. And he has told many people that story. And there have been nobody that's ever refuted it. And I met him and talked to him. And he was a good guy. And he was just not the kind of guy that would make up something like that. All the other stories, he didn't make up anything.
When you went and you interviewed him for the movie Gangland Wire, the documentary, you put that in, didn't you?
That's in the special features.
That's in there.
It really
was
not germane to the skimming.
But it was relevant to...
It was relevant to the law enforcement. So it's that interview is a special feature on my documentary. Now, you can't get those special features by doing the digital download, the...
Amazon.
Renting it. You have to go to my website to buy a DVD copy. Because the DVD is not for sale on Amazon, only the digital download, but you can't get that special feature there.
Well, actually, there's a couple of different special features on the DVD.
Yeah, there's more than one.
But that one I remember.
That's
I remember
a good
him telling that story. And the interesting thing to me would be that, you know, that night, the attorney that went to talk to those folks in Chicago knew probably what room he was in.
Yeah.
At what hotel he was at.
Sure.
So instead of a phone call, there easily could have been a knock at the door.
I tell you what, you'd want to come well strapped if you knocked at that door that night. I'll bet you.
You think he might have been?
You understand what I mean by well strapped?
Yeah.
Okay. Kind of a long pause there. You're going to come knocking on Kent Clifford's door
I don't think you're talking about ready. You're not talking about like a good belt.
I'm not talking about a good
pair
belt.
Of suspenders.
I never forget using that word strapped or strapped up. You don't hear that very much anymore. You never hear it in movies or on TV.
But that's what the term they use
all the time.
In the 70s?
You know, you're carrying a weapon.
Are you strapping?
Strapped, yeah. Well strapped. Yeah, I'm strapping. He's strapped. One time we were doing a surveillance on some, and these weren't mob guys, but they were just professional criminals, and they were, when the guy was running a fencing operation, we knew he was buying TV sets and stereos and all that kind of stuff from burglar. You know, when you have your house burglarized, they always take your TV and your stereo, especially back then. So we're running surveillance, and it's in a black neighborhood, and me and my partner are white, and we'd followed him once, and he met a guy, and he looked at something in the trunk, and we thought, he's up to it. And so we get hold of another police officer who's black, and he gets a what we call a slick car. It was like a 73 Nova or something. Drives up in the neighborhood, and he sits up close enough where he can see who's coming and going. We want him to start picking up license numbers and really try to get a pattern on this guy and find out more about him. Well, this guy was pretty jumpy. I don't know if it was because we had followed him a little bit earlier, and all we had like a – it was an unmarked police car is what it was. It was a Plymouth Fury that looked like a police car without the lights on it. He may have been jumpy already, but he wasn't really jumpy about the police. He was jumpy about somebody ripping him off, apparently, because he came out. Some guys, like two guys, came over to the fence's house, and then all three of them jumped in the car, and they came out, and they drove around the block, and they came back up behind this black policeman who's sitting there in plain clothes in a Chevy Nova, helping us with our surveillance, and they pulled right up next to him. And Ron, luckily Ron was sitting right next to a church, because they pulled up, they rolled down the window and said, hey, what you doing, man? He said, I ain't doing nothing. He said, well, what are you sitting there for? What are you up to? Russell says, you know, I don't know. He said, I'm going to be clean. I'm a cleanup guy. He said, I'm going to be cleaning this church up in a minute as soon as the preacher gets there and unlocks it. He said, well, he said, you know, I guess you're okay. He said, good thing for you. He says, because, you know, we're ready for you. And he said, man, he said, I'm strapped too. Get it on. And Ron reaches down to get he's pulling the gun out, which he had one. This guy said, oh, just cool it, man. It's okay. We're getting out of here. So they used to use that, I'm strapped.
Mm-hmm. And people knew what that meant.
And they knew exactly what that meant.
But he wasn't going to clean the church.
No.
If they went around the block a couple more times, they'd see the car still sitting. I'm still waiting on the minister.
Right, exactly. It was a good cover.
That was. Quick thinking.
Yep. Although, when they did that, we saw them going down there trying to confront him. So we moved on in with our police-looking car, and then they saw us, and they boogied on out. We never saw him again. We couldn't. You just couldn't leave him sitting down there hanging out to dry all by himself because we didn't know exactly what was going
on. Yeah, how that was going to go down, whether he was strapping or not, because they might have been too.
Oh, you bet they were. That's, you know, we would have got him stopped, but they boogied on out and got out of there.
Well, I'm looking. They actually have a Wikipedia page for Ralph Lamb, kind of where we started this with the sheriff's department.
Oh, yeah, Ralph Lamb, the sheriff.
Yeah, was born April 10th of 1927, and he died July 3rd. 2015.
Yeah, just last year, a year and a half ago.
Here it says there's some other stuff. It said in 1958, he made a bid to be the next sheriff of the county, but lost to Butch Leopold, which is what we'd said. Leopold served in 1961. Then he was promoted to the Nevada Gaming Control Board. Lamb was named his successor. Would have been in 1961 and would go on to serve until 1978. Lamb spearheaded the change. Lamb spearheaded the charge against the mob moving into Las Vegas during that time.
Yeah, he really did.
Or maybe not.
I wonder who wrote that wiki page.
There's a reference there, too, to
he was pretty well liked out there. You know, it's not fair to say that he was, like, bought and paid for by the mob, because as our friend Bill Friedman says, they needed mob guys to know how to run casinos. And so he was part of that old school. That all started changing there in the middle 70s, and they got that John Moran, and they added a little more professional staff to the gaming control board, and so it all started changing. So it's not really fair to say he's some kind of a corrupt sheriff, but he wasn't all that squeaky clean. He didn't mind if Lefty Rosenthal worked in a casino, and everybody knew what Lefty Rosenthal was.
Yeah, here it says, this was actually not from the Wikipedia, but from the Las Vegas Review-Journal, an article that was published on July 3rd of 2015. Clark County Sheriff Lamb dies at 88.
What do they say about him? They say he was a mob buster.
Former Clark County Sheriff Ralph Lamb died Friday afternoon at age 88. He was famous twice, once in the 1960s when his word was law in a county colonized by organized crime, and again in 2012 and 13 when his earlier exploits were fictionalized in a TV cop show.
Yeah, that was the one with
Vegas.
Vegas, yeah. You know, Nicholas Pileggi wrote that. He worked on that. That's one of the reasons he stood me up. I was supposed to go interview him, and at the last minute, I had my tickets bought to fly to New York City and interview him for my movie. And he calls me back at the last minute, or emails me back, and says, "You know, I've got to go to Los Angeles on some business, on some work." He said, unfortunately, he said, that's where they do the TV and make the movies. And then about a year later, year and a half later, by this film comes out. So I imagine he was working on that then.
Working on that.
Actually, this TV show comes out. He's probably working on that then.
Here it says his brother, Darwin Lamb, a former Clark County commissioner, said that accomplishments helped make him the top lawman in the county's accomplishments helped make him the top lawman the county's ever seen. Quote unquote, "He was the best ever," Lamb's last surviving sibling said. "You could go anywhere and they'd tell you the same thing. Even the crooks respected him. When he told them something, they knew he meant it."
Yeah, he played kind of fast and loose with the rules all the way around. But he was okay. I mean, he just wasn't the big mob buster that everybody wants to make him out to be. That's pretty well was documented on that letter he wrote verifying that Lefty Rosenthal was okay to the Florida Gaming Commission. Now, why would a sheriff have any business writing a letter for a guy like Lefty Rosenthal?
Well, here, the article goes on. I mean, it's a long article. We might just link to it because it's so long. But indicted in 1977... he was indicted on income tax evasion allegations. Federal prosecutors tried to prove that his lifestyle, which included building a new home with a guest house and horsemanship facilities, required more money than he earned as sheriff or reported on his taxes. They asserted that the $30,000 loan from casino operator Benny Binion. Casino operator Benny Binion was never meant to be repaid and therefore was income on which Lamb should have paid taxes.
So, like I said, he was a multidimensional character. Many shades of gray there. All right, Aaron, I think I've told enough stories tonight. I'm still tired from being out there in Las Vegas yesterday. I had an early flight, and when I have an early flight, I wake up about every hour all night long. You know, when I first woke up this morning, I flipped on the TV about 5:30, and the local news said the power went out, the MGM Grand in New York, New York, and that was, we were staying at the Tropicana, of course, well-known by Kansas City mob, the Tropicana, where Joe Augusto was setting up the skim for Nick Civella. But I looked across the street, and MGM was pitch dark, and the New York was pitch dark. It was kind of scary. I was glad it wasn't our hotel. I'd hate to be up in one of those, 10 or 15-story hotels that are about a block wide and a block deep and
no lights,
no electricity. You couldn't go down the elevator. You couldn't do anything.
Well, probably have battery powered, like lights in the hallway or something.
They probably have some battery powered lights, but you're not going to be able to run, you're not going to be running that elevator on any battery powered emergency lights.
Yeah, I know. They're probably backing all those batteries up and generators up for the casino floor.
Yeah, really. Keep all that power would then go to the casino floor to keep the machines.
Keep those
running.
Machines rolling.
Really, they got them back on about an hour later, but boy, I was wanting out of there. Like, what if we lose power? Let's just get out of here and get to the airport, and who knows what's happening here, and maybe some terrorist attack or something on Las Vegas. That would be a prime place. Boy, there's a lot of people on the streets all the time out there. All right, I'm gonna make my last pitch. Give us a donation, folks. Help us amp up the stories and the production values.
Throw down some money for the...
If I got enough money, I would hire a sound designer to add music and sound effects at the right time to try to catch up with the big boys.
Well, you're doing that now.
I do a little bit of that now. I add music. Our good friend Casey McBride has given us some music, and I've got some other music that I bought a few years ago for my movies that I can put in there for moods to increase the mood of it. But let me make my public service announcement. If you have a problem with addiction, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks need to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And, of course, you could go to Amazon and rent or own the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire. But why would you want to do that when what you want to do is make a $25 donation? One-time $25 donation, and Gary will send you an autographed copy with the extras that you can't get if you stream it on Amazon.
That's correct. That's what you want to do. All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.